You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Well, folks, guess what? Fantasy football's back, and DraftKings.com is not messing around, okay? Here's how it works. You could win enormous cash prizes every week. And what I mean by that is you can get free entry into the Millionaire Maker event, which, by the way, means that if you take first place, if you really think you know sports, you will take home $1 million. All you got to do is head to DraftKings.com now, enter promo code Callen, my last name, C-A-L-L-E-N, to play free to become a millionaire, or at least win $1 million. DraftKings.com. Bigger events, bigger winnings, bigger millionaires. Enter Callen, C-A-L-L-E-N, L-L-L-L-L-E-N, for free entry now at DraftKings.com. That is DraftKings.com. Got me? See how I pop the T and I pronounce the S on Kings? DraftKings.com. Back to the podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, back by popular demand, Vanessa Tyson, assistant professor of political science at UCLA, scholar in residence at the Bunch Center for African American Studies. Welcome, my
Thank
lady.
You. Thank
Welcome.
You.
We've been talking very passionately before we started this podcast about education, and Hunter is very passionate about it, and actually got pretty his cockles up. And you were talking about the fact that most of our attention and even our resources are applied in the wrong place when it comes to education, when what we really need is, you were talking, I think, Vanessa, you kind of agreed that a lot of kids don't understand how to learn.
They don't understand that they can learn.
They don't understand that they can learn. So money is one thing when you say we need more money for education, but you were also talking about how it's got to be up to the child to manage his own attention.
Yeah.
But then Vanessa said, yes, but it's also important to be compassionate and understanding that the environment that some of these kids come from can be violent or full of terror, or they're not being fed properly. That environment needs to be fixed. Yes, that's where, and you were talking about how programs that help children manage stress or whatever it might be with professionals can help. You used a great example of you used to have a major speech impediment. You worked with a speech therapist. It helped. But then Hunter came back with something that I think we'll start the podcast on, which was that the vast majority of kids do have conducive environments for learning. They do have enough to eat. They are not coming from, they don't have bruises all over their bodies from being beaten by a parent or whoever. And yet most kids don't know how to read and don't know how to even write. And we're talking about high schoolers.
Yeah.
And by the way, college.
Yeah. Yes. And a lot of adults too. I mean, that's the thing is that Brian and I were talking about this. I went to some of the fanciest schools in the world. I never learned how to read. I never learned how to write. I was convinced that punctuation was just arbitrary. Like my whole high school career, I thought I understood how a full stop worked. I understood how a question mark worked. And then I pretty much understood what an exclamation mark was for and used it regularly and often, maybe a little too often. And then, but commas were an utter mystery to me. It just seemed totally arbitrary. And then I would get my paper back and they would be all marked wrong. And I would be like, clearly my teacher hates me because, my commas are wrong or semicolons or anything like that. And so the thing is that I 100%, I've talked about this before, but when I first voted in 2000, right, I was shocked at how unequipped I was for that job because I was like, okay, so I have no idea who, judges, commissioners, all of the stuff that's once you get past the congressman and the senator, who are these people? Mm-hmm. And then ballot initiatives, I don't know. I can make a sort of spot decision, but I'm not even really sure of that. And then when I was really honest, really, really honest about why I was voting for the presidential candidate that I was voting for, everybody made fun of Republicans for voting for Bush because he was the kind of president you could have a beer with. But honestly, if I'm really honest, the reason why I voted for Gore was because he was the kind of president you can have a latte with.
That's
fair.
Interesting.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I actually worked on Gore 2000.
He's part of,
You did.
Yeah. It was a fundraiser for Al Gore and then Gore Lieberman.
Vanessa, though, you from an early age had an interest in learning. And
yeah.
I think you just said you're just self-described nerd. But you What do you think it was, and what are your experiences with what works with students and what doesn't work with students?
Well, let's see. I mean, with me, I just had a lot of curiosity. And, you know, I also had a babysitter who was very well-educated but wanted to stay home with her kids. I mean, my mom talked about this last week. She was like, you know, sometimes she was like, I also loved to play. I did love to play. But the thing was, is that everything had to be finished. All of my homework had to be finished, and it had to be finished right before I was allowed to go and play with my friends. Yeah, I know. Well, yeah. I mean, but okay, fine. If that's the way it works, if those were the rules, and those were the rules of my house, there was no TV, no video games, none of this stuff. But, you know, I would come home, and my babysitter actually talked to my mom about this because apparently, you know, she was concerned that I wouldn't even stop to get a snack. I just wanted to get my homework done, get it done right so that I could go out, you know, over to my best friend Amy Cole's house and play with our Cabbage Patch Kids.
Okay. So when you have a kid that isn't that way.
Okay.
How do you deal?
When you have a kid that isn't that way.
And you may not be dealing with it much.
But yeah. First off, then we have to ask the question, why is the kid not that way? Because I think what's really important is your mom set very clear expectations, very clear standards. And the result of that was that you met those, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I definitely think this had to do with the rules of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it was definitely something where my mother said, you know, like, I mean, there would be very little TV,
mm-hmm.
very little. I was allowed to watch the news and, of course, C-SPAN. And then what happens over time, you know, was that...
Mom was really upset that you wanted to watch C-SPAN.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, she was like, oh, God,
who is this kid
watching
C-SPAN?
Exactly. Though I did also love Wonder Woman. But, I mean,
yeah.
I could watch Wonder Woman once a week if I was getting, you know, all A's in my homework.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So any privileges that I had were contingent upon, you know, was I working hard enough at school?
Carrot and stick stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I had all of my chores. I had my responsibilities, right? And I had a long list of responsibilities, but they were written out. And they had to be done, and they had to be done to satisfactory completion, right?
Clearly defined standards, transparency, all of these things, the same things that work in government.
Exactly.
Okay. But
it helped because, A, I had structure, right? B, I had clearly defined expectations that I knew I had to meet before I could have fun. And if I wanted to have fun, then I was going to have to do, you know, then I was going to have to comply.
Mm.
And I think that what I've seen with a number of parents, you know, is that, you know, that for instance, screen time, right, that these kids are just watching TV all the time,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's not conditional,
mm-hmm.
right? That this is just, like I understood life with, I mean, even my crayon privileges were conditional.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow. Oh, yeah.
I'm learning from this because I need to be more that way with my kids.
Everything was conditional. Now, my mom wasn't strict per se. To other people, she might seem strict. Like, she, you know, I got spanked twice.
You grew up with the order of the universe was that if you want to play, you want to do that thing over there that's fun, you got to work for it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a good model, working model for what your life is going to be like as an adult, that's for damn sure.
Oh, yeah. But my mom was very, you know, she was just very structured. And she was very loving and affectionate woman, like just adorable,
yeah.
you know, and still my favorite person.
But do you find that we have a culture, and this is for both of you, do you find that we have a culture where that's a little sticky, isn't it? Where, you know, this conditional. Fun is conditional based on, and I think that is the way the world works. I think that your mother was dead on. But it feels like a lot of parents kind of are scared to really be that conditional a lot of times.
Well, I think a lot of parents are very concerned. You know, it's what I see with my friends who have kids, and I don't have any myself. But, you know, there's this that in effort to keep the peace, they concede and concede and concede. And in ways that seem highly unhealthy,
mm-hmm.
right? The, you know, kid throws a temper tantrum. Okay, we'll go to the toy store.
So do you find that a lot? Do you find that attitude in your new students?
Oh, my God. Well, I haven't started teaching at UCLA. Classes don't start until, like, the end of September. But I can say amongst, you know, my former students, you know, you have some real gems, but you also have some kids who are still kind of in the temper tantrum mode.
And how old are they?
20.
Wow. Hunter, what about you?
I think that's the thing. I think, firstly, boundaries are, you know, well established as a concept in psychology. We all know that there are boundaries in any relationship, whether it's romantic or parenting or anything like that. Mm. And I think that's the funny thing is that, you know, the mistake is that by not setting boundaries, then the removal of toys or anything like that becomes about whether you love me. As opposed to when you set boundaries, like, this is not me, this is rule of law. Like, yes. These are the rules. Yes. Like, I have to obey them, you have to obey them, and it has absolutely nothing to do with how I feel about you.
You know, you're supposed to train dogs the same way.
Yeah.
When you train a dog, don't hit the dog. Just when you are training the dog, if the dog doesn't comply, doesn't follow you, he realizes he gets tugged right off his feet. It's not your fault. It's just he's like, mm-hmm. Oh, I got to keep my eye on this guy because if I don't, he's going to turn abruptly and turn me the other mm-hmm. way. And that's how you get a dog to heal. And I mean, so what? The dog isn't taking it personally. He's not saying he's being punished.
Exactly.
He's like, oh, wait, I'm doing a little math in my head. I got to keep my eyes on my owner and stay at his knee. If I don't, he might turn abruptly and yank me the other way, and it doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, sure. that's the Kohler technique.
And dogs are basically the emotional equivalent of a 3-year-old.
Yeah.
But I think that there are a lot of parents who are so worried about, you know, being their child's friend that they don't necessarily realize, no, I need to be a parent. Hmm. Right.
Well, because the world will parent you. The fact of the matter is, if you haven't done your work, and if you don't know how to learn, if you don't know how to focus, and if you haven't worked at getting
but the
good
problem
at something, you don't get the goodies.
But yeah. The world is a terrible parent. The problem is that the feedback that people get from the world is so confusing and
yes.
so complicated, and it's so yes. easy to rationalize away why these things are happening and, mm-hmm. and, you know, make it not about, like, simple choices and all that sort of stuff. And I think that the biggest thing is that, you know, A, there's the rules of, like, you do this, like, da-da-da-da-da. But I think the other thing that's important to note in what happens when Vanessa is talking is that her self-concept is formed around being a person who gets things done and gets them done well. So that at a certain point, it's no longer even about the rules. Like, the rules become irrelevant because now she's doing it because that's who she is, that her self-worth is tied up in that. She could never allow herself to do something that's substandard. Like, you know, I mean, she has become a nerd. Like, that is what
yeah.
ends up happening. And, you know, I mean, there's part of that is biochemical in terms of, like, the feedback of feeling good, of doing something and doing it well and all of that sort of stuff. But I think the thing that I would also say that's super important that people don't realize with all of this stuff, right, is that level of things becoming personal then attacks how they approach school.
Yes.
Because now they start reading a book and they don't understand it. And rather than saying, I didn't do it in the right way, I didn't do it in the way that all human beings have to read things, it becomes about, I'm not a person who can read and understand things.
Mm. Yeah.
You know?
They start to essentialize.
Everything becomes essentialized. And this is, you know, Carol Dweck's work is sort of is part of a larger thing, which is learned helplessness, which is Martin Seligman's work. And essentially what they found is that basically, people have explanatory styles, right? Mm-hmm. And it's how they explain why things happen to them, right? And so the three parameters for that are things are personal, pervasive, and persistent, right? So there's a big difference between saying, you know, oh, I got a C on a math test, right? Because, you know, I just didn't get the math gene. Well, you've made it personal, pervasive, and persistent. Right. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's personal. The problem is me. Right. It's permanent. Right. Because I didn't get the math gene. Like, that's not a thing I can change. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's pervasive. Like, that's going to affect all of math forever for all time. So what you've done is that, you know, you may think that you're telling the truth, but you've chosen an explanation which makes you have no control. There are real, like, that's not only just like, in terms of the words, like, that actually has psychological effects that kicks you into a state called learned helplessness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's the thing is that these explanatory styles are really, really important. And the problem is that we deal with all of this stuff as if it's truth. Like, somebody says, I didn't get the math gene or whatever it is. And we're like, that's just a fact. Like, I'm just saying that.
And also, and Vanessa, you were talking about how there's this great think tank.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about California.
Yeah, Anderson Forecast.
The Anderson Forecast. And they make these great recommendations to Sacramento. Mm-hmm. And guess what? They don't get listened to.
Rarely. I mean,
we deal with this with adults.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I mean, certainly. I mean, it seems like, you know, no matter what level you're at, right? Even when you have quality information, it's whether or not that information is actually, you know, being distributed to the masses, mm-hmm. or at least distributed to those who are in power, who can allocate resources in such a way to do so, right? The Anderson forecast has been around for at least 20 years. You know, I used to love to read it. You know, they would have quarterly forecasts on a variety of topics, everything from energy usage, traffic congestion, you name it. Mm. You know, a little book, you know, about this big, you know, about, you know, maybe 200 pages thick of various, you know, reports, right, that you could learn to learn. I mean, basically, it is a crash course in California politics and policy. Mm-hmm. It's run out of UCLA's Anderson School of Management. And it's just brilliant. But it is hard, I think, when you have people who are in positions of power who are not open necessarily to, you know, suggestions from experts, right? I mean, this is a constant phenomenon, right? People get set in their
ways.
They're
wary of experts, too, you know?
Yeah, well, but yeah. I think it's more than that. It's that they don't know how to learn. They think that most of our leaders in this country think that learning is about always knowing the right answer immediately, you know, and that's something that the voters encourage. Like, the voters have that wrong idea.
Don't be a waffler.
A flip-flopper. Yeah. Mm. I mean, that's the point, is we have the wrong idea of learning as voters, and that translates into our who we vote for and everything else. Now, Brian, I have a question for you, mm-hmm. you know. So over, because I think that one of the major, major issues in this country, I think the root issue is basically what we believe about learning, because the intellectual ecosystem in this country is broken, right? So I want to ask you, over the last year, in terms of talking to all the people that we've talked to, reading all these books and all this sort of stuff, right? How has that changed how you view the problems in our society?
Well, I mean, it's revolutionized them in a way. In terms of, you know, you were just talking about you can allocate a lot of money to education, but what is most important is getting an idea out there. It's, in a weird way, a lot cheaper to get, how do you get a good idea to replace a bad idea? That is where the focus has to be. And mm-hmm. the more you learn about how people learn, mm-hmm. the more you learn about the learning process, and the more you start to see what is wrong, mm-hmm. and you're able to start to identify the root of the problem. So it is, you're right. It's one thing for most of us to say, well, we need more education, money for education. Well, none of us know what that means. You know what that means. And you know, you would know exactly where to allocate it. But then Hunter comes along and says, yeah, and by the way, we also need to get a very important idea out there.
Sure.
Which is,
I think, I mean, you know, and listen, I mean, there's no disagreement about what the goal is,
yeah,
right?
No,
the question
we're on
is,
the same team.
Yeah, everybody, well, but I mean, you know, I don't know how you could be on any other team.
But let me give you another example. Well, the Iraq War would have gone a lot smoother if we hadn't fired the entire army, the entire interior ministry, the entire security apparatus. Mm-hmm. These were men to the tune of, and the families that they supported and everything else. You fired about 500,000, mostly men, military age, most of whom were armed, most of whom had a purpose, most of whom had intimate knowledge not only of the culture of Iraq, because, oh, well, by the way, it's been around since the Garden of Eden. And I hope you guys know that the Garden of Eden existed. But it's been around a long time. They know how to do some things. And you took about 500,000 of them overnight and went, you guys are fired. You no longer can get a job. See you later. Talk about creating an insurgency. Would have been much cheaper if somebody had listened, if Bremer had listened, and Rumsfeld, who is just, I don't want to get started, but if he had just listened to some of the people who were experts, like our intelligence.
Or if he'd read history.
Or he had read some history.
This was a long time coming. I mean, you know, the U.S. seems, one of the things that I hate about U.S. foreign policy is that we seem guilty of repeating our mistakes over and over again.
Right.
And
it's the same problem, isn't it?
But why are we guilty of repeating? What is it that causes us to repeat our mistakes and not
our
learn from them?
Our models.
And why are our models not changing? Because they are. The funny thing is that
they're going to be forced on us. They are going to change.
Well, but no, but they're not. I mean, this is, again, where the world is a bad parent. Like the problem is that what happens is that, you know, you have an administration, right? They do whatever nutty stuff they do, right? And then part of partisan politics is like, you know, and part of what the voters want is that they, you know, they want a change of blood, right? So you get a whole new set of people in there who make the exact same mistakes all over the again.
Certainly, but I think there are certain people, I mean, you know, Rumsfeld is case in point of someone who just makes the same mistakes, is the same person but makes the same mistakes over
sure.
again, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so you have, like, certain regimes, if you will, that seem much more comfortable with, you know, kind of a hawkish approach to foreign policy. But I think another thing that you also want to consider is that, you know,
but
that,
can we,
that
can I, can
just
we,
just to make a quick yeah. point is that much of the intelligence community and the money that had been going into intelligence, you know, after what you see in like the late Clinton years, right? Part of the balanced budget was a decimation of the intelligence budget. Mm-hmm. And consequently, you see much less information, you know, being shared that for what in various
well,
ways.
You know what that was about. That was the law where they realized there was one of our CIA informants had connections to death squads in Central America. And then I can't remember the law, but the senator pushed back this law, this essentially saying, look, we, the CIA, our intelligence community are not allowed to essentially hire criminals,
yeah.
people who have blood on their hands. Well, the problem is you want to catch a bank robber, you got to talk to other criminals.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
so that was a huge issue. And Clinton was pretty hostile to our intelligence community, apparently, from what I've read. You know, I don't know.
But
yeah, and George H.W. Bush, for what it was worth, for obvious reasons, he was not, right? That you know, so you had a sustained intelligence community, you know, with problems, of course, you know, like throughout the Reagan era and, mm-hmm. and on to H.W. Bush, who had been the prior director of the CIA, mm-hmm. right? So you had a strong relationship there. And then you go to the Clinton years where you see, you know, a lot of cuts happening, you know, to foreign policy, but specifically to intelligence, right? Mm-hmm. And Bob Baer, I don't know if you guys have read his books, but you know, like a lot of what was the movie Styriana, with George
Great
Clooney
yeah.
and others, right? Part of that was loosely based upon, you know, See No Evil, written by Bob Baer, who talked about how as the money drained out of intelligence, right? So you know that they were no longer able to afford informants. In fact, they were no longer able to afford any staff, like mm-hmm. U.S.
Well,
staff.
You can go a step further. Very few people even spoke Arabic, and very few people
or
even
Farsi.
Knew much about the history of the country because
yeah.
a lot of them had dried up. They sure. retired.
But to go back, I mean, I think that's the thing, right? Is that yeah, bad models, right?
Yes.
We've
yes.
established
Sorry.
Bad models, but then the thing is that you know, yes, I mean, there are problems with being hawkish. There were also problems with being dovish.
Sure.
And
sure,
I think
sure, sure.
that's the point is that what we don't have is we don't have a nuanced model that mm-hmm. allows us to distinguish between these situations. Because, you know, the United States just oscillates between interventionism and, you know, isolationism. And both are problematic. I mean, you know, and again, you know, but I think that's the thing is that for me, it's, you know, this is a democracy.
Yeah.
In name, certainly. And to some degree in practice, right? I think the
yeah.
basic institutions are there. The problem is that in a democracy, if you want to point the finger, you always have to point the finger at the people because
sure.
ultimately they decide.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing is that, you know, the people have abrogated their responsibility. They have grown comfortable with the fact that the United States is great, that it is powerful, and that it always will be.
And that it works.
And that we have stopped watching. We have stopped doing our jobs. We have stopped reading up. And we have stopped figuring out what should our foreign policy be so that that's what we demand. And so that when you have somebody like Clinton who's going to, you know, cut funding to the CIA, you're like, no, Clinton, you can't do that. Or when
so,
you have,
but
you know.
So then
but
on
yeah,
that
I mean,
point,
people are busy
Vanessa.
Watching Kim Kardashian.
Well, but that's the thing.
But let me move this over to you now,
okay.
Vanessa, because
okay.
let's talk a little bit about how our government actually works,
sure.
speaking of models.
Sure.
And let's talk about what works and doesn't work. So let me give you a scenario. Let's talk about, because I'm ignorant to this.
Okay.
I mean, I have an idea, but
sure.
So I want to fix something in
okay.
my community.
Sure.
I want to fix something in Los Angeles.
Sure.
Let's just say we need to deal with this traffic situation.
Let's just say.
So I, what, do, and I'm a politician or I'm a community organizer. You've worked at the grassroots level. How do things actually get done in our government? Let's say a group of people get together and they want to pass a law.
Sure. Okay. So, okay, you want to get together, you want to pass a law. Now, it depends on if you need to do something at the city, county, state level, federal level, what have you.
So there are four different levels.
Yeah, for the most part. Okay. I mean, you know, it depends. Like, so for instance, you could also, like, ask for a ruling from, like, a regulatory agency or, you know, like a municipal water board, which is separate from like the county commissioners or this or that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so there's multiple entities. With traffic, right, what you're really looking at probably is trying to get money out of Caltrans. But then you have to think about kind of what are the issues at play here? Like, one of the issues is simply the idea that you have so many people, you have so many cars, and you have Los Angeles in particular is so built out. Yeah. This wasn't smart growth. Like for almost a century, the way that buildings in California or in Los Angeles worked was that you weren't allowed to build any skyscrapers. No buildings were allowed to be taller than the city hall, right?
Because of earthquakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, was the justification.
That was the justification, but you know, there was also energy interests that were very vested in making, like, particularly gasoline and what have you, that were very vested in making sure that they wanted people driving.
Right.
You know,
and the car companies and the rubber companies and the tire companies.
Yes.
My uncle, who works for the railroad, rants about this a lot.
Okay.
Exactly. And that's the thing is that, you know, so what you had largely, whereas, you know, New York, whereas D.C., they were all investing in infrastructure towards, you know, quality public transit. They were building up and not necessarily out. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, you had California and Southern California in particular that was doing exactly the opposite. Right. So to kind of back up and understand where the problem started, right? This is the design unto itself was not smart, right?
But faulty infrastructure.
But hold on, to back up even further, right? It's not the design.
Yeah.
It's special interests. Like, that is the root problem. And that's my problem, Brian, is that, you know, you have, like, a particular issue, which is that you got stuck on the 405, right? But I guarantee you, and this is what I really want to hear from Vanessa, let's say that Brian goes in and he tries to fix the 405.
There you go.
How are his good intentions going to be utterly screwed up
by
special interests?
Excellent question.
They will. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, dead upon arrival. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't try, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and with your charm and good looks.
Thank you.
And the lovely voice.
Thank you.
Right?
Much.
Like,
yeah.
You may just make
Ladies
inroads. You may just make inroads that perhaps others cannot. So here's what you would be doing. You would be going to Caltrans and you'd be saying, look, this is absolutely ridiculous. Like, you know, for instance, maybe we need more park and ride, you know, areas where we can that link to public transportation. DC does this and they keep expanding, right? So right now they're in the process of expanding all the way out to Dulles Airport, which nobody thought could be done, but they're doing it. Right. And it's beautiful and it's brilliant and it's being it's being funded both by the state of Virginia as well as Washington, D.C. as a group project. Mm-hmm. Right. Because so many people fly in and out of Dulles Airport that they need that there. So the first thing is like identifying the need, which we know the 405 has. But then the question becomes, you know, how do we create more effective modes of transportation in a place that is so built out? You need to have park and rides, but you also need to have more effective public transportation within the city itself. There's no reason why there shouldn't be a line along Pico. Right? You know, like a subway line along Pico. Right?
Yeah.
And there should also probably be one along Wilshire.
But
right?
Good luck laying those tracks down and closing up stores in the process.
Well, and more importantly, allowing poor people to go to the beach, which is the great fear of every Santa Monica resident. Like that.
Hey,
so,
wait a minute.
No, but seriously, that's so much of why. I mean, why has the, you know, the metro not allowed to reach the sea? Yeah, it's because, like, listen, the rich people don't want the poor people at the beach. Like,
I paid a lot for this beachfront property.
And I don't want, I mean, imagine. Listen,
and there's a long history of that.
I don't like people of your genre on my side.
Well, listen, you know, it used to be, even in L.A., that the community pools were segregated and that blacks and Latinos were not allowed to swim in the community pools because I think the white people thought it was, like, contagious or something.
Jeez.
Like, or that black people were rumored to be dirty.
Orientalism is definitely definitely contagious.
Oh, really?
Excuse me.
Oh, dear Lord.
This is a quality podcast. I won't have this bigotry. I do have a point, but I will not stand with this bigotry.
Some of the finest phrenologists in this land have proven that it's possible.
Yes. I've not yet examined their skulls, but I will say.
But yes, I mean, look, like what the problem is that, you know, when money is short, right, you know, like trying to come up with the funds to improve infrastructure and to like increase infrastructure is, you know, abysmally low. But even when money is not short, right, infrastructure, it's not a sexy topic. No. Right? And it's not a topic. I mean, look.
Which is, by the way, the same thing that you see in education. iPads are sexy. Thinking is not. Like, you know, the research all, I mean, like the National Academy of Sciences published this huge 700-page report. This is the National Academy of Sciences. Like, we paid for this report. Yeah. And the report says, what is the difference between effective students and ineffective students? Metacognition. Thinking about thinking. We've talked about this before. But try, like, you know, if you're a politician and you go out and give a stump speech about how, you know, we're going to bring metacognition to our schools and da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
It's not quite the same as saying every child will have an iPad.
Well, you know, criminals like new guns.
Yeah.
New guns. They were finding that most people shooting other people, like the gang kids, they wanted the new guns.
Of course.
So when they started clamping down on gun you know merchants who were selling those, they isolated it in like the tri-state area of New York and Connecticut. They isolated, I think, it down to 3 gun dealers who were getting those new guns to all these people.
Sure. So one thing I would say, also kind of piggybacking off of that, is that, you know, yes, people love the idea of like iPads for every kid, but at the same time, we're not actually seeing that kids learn any better.
No.
With iPads. I mean, I won't use PowerPoint in my classrooms, right? You know, and this is something that is, you know, I'm old school, sure. But the thing is, we're now finding studies that say that, you know, you use PowerPoint and people don't learn. They zone off into the PowerPoint.
Yeah, of course.
They write down, you know, like what's on the PowerPoint, but they don't actually listen. And listening is a key component. Like listening, like notice as I'm writing, you know, we're talking, I'm taking notes, right? Yeah, but that's because
she's a nerd.
Exactly.
Way to show us up.
No, but the thing is, though, is that, you know, like I want to hold on to these ideas.
Of course.
And, you know, when you have something like PowerPoint, people just write down what is on the PowerPoint. They zone out completely. I mean, it's like lulling them to sleep.
Right. Have you seen Brené Brown's TED Talk, like her first
one? Oh, The Power of Vulnerability?
Yeah.
Okay.
The thing that I love about that is the degree to which she uses no slides.
Yeah.
Like, the point is that she has, like, a few, like, random images that don't even have, like, a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. But it's a 15-minute talk. I think it's the best TED Talk I've ever seen. And it's like no slides. Just because that's the point, is that slides distract. But
well, Sheryl Sandberg was the same way, you know, like that was like, you know, one of kind of her rise to fame, you know, like with the whole lean in, you know, her talk very much, you know, captivated her audience. They were paying attention to her. They were interested in what she had to say.
Right.
Wait a minute. Are you saying humanity is more important than technology? Because that's not true.
But so back to this. Like, so, you know, part of this is that infrastructure is not sexy, right? Education, or the nuts and bolts of education,
are not sexy.
Yeah.
Even the words are not sexy. When you say literally, when you say infrastructure and education, I have to concentrate.
I know. Well, people are like,
Atul Gawande, just as like a quick side point,
sure.
Like his book, The Checklist Manifesto, right? So 1 million people every year die from preventable surgical error. This is things like surgeons leaving sponges inside the body, not washing their hands before, not administering an antibiotic. Yeah. A checklist, right, which requires, you know, one photocopy, right, can reduce those deaths by 45%. But you know what everybody's spending their money on? Surgical robots, which have shown no improvement in patient outcomes. Because surgical robots, like iPads, like everything else, like new guns, are sexy.
Yeah. But also, I mean, I think this goes to another structural issue, which is, you know, that the way campaigns are set up, it's that the quality of a candidate does not measure the quality of a legislator or the quality of a leader in general, right? I could be boring as all get out, but be the most amazing senator ever.
Angela Merkel.
Right?
Would you say if I told you as I was the emperor of the world, I would give politicians 70% less TV time?
You would give politicians 70%
less? 70% less TV time. So I wouldn't let you really see the politician as much. So you didn't make a judgment on his hair or his look. I'd rather, you'd have to listen to him on a radio.
I don't think I'd have a problem with that. Yeah. I mean, even when you think about, like, you know, the 1960 debate between Kennedy and, mm-hmm. and Nixon, right? This was a classic example, yeah. right? Now, you know, I am a Democrat, and for those of you listeners, you're going to have to forgive me. But you know, if you listened to it, right, Nixon was clearly, you know, the more informed, was clear. And I'm from Nixon's hometown, by the way. I was actually the VIP greeter at the Nixon funeral. true story. I had to talk with Henry Kissinger. Tell you about that later.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
It
was
very nice, too.
No, he was very upset because people were telling jokes. They made it sound like a sitcom.
Oh, my God.
Very upset. He's very.
He's been here for about 50 years, and he's still upset.
I know. I'm like, the guy doesn't die. But anyways, so suffice it to say, right, is that, you know, if you listen to this, right, Nixon is clearly the winner, right? He clearly knows the issues. He clearly knows the topic. But this is the first televised debate, right, that we've ever, you know, that we'd – presidential debate that we'd had in U.S. history. And John F. Kennedy is clearly the more telegenic, right? If you actually look at Richard Nixon, you can see that he's sweating bullets, mm-hmm. right? Like, he's just – you know, he's clearly not – you know, the composed yeah. person, you know, and eventually Kennedy wins, though ostensibly it could have, arguably it could have been because lots of dead people were voting in Chicago. surprise, surprise. But this goes to say, right, that, you know, like, what if, you know, you actually, you know, had campaigns run on ideas and not on personalities? Right. And that's not to say that there isn't something to be gleaned from the type of person someone is. Right.
Like, but say that again. That's a great thing to say.
What if you had campaigns that were based on ideas, that were based on actual legitimate platforms and not on personalities?
Right.
Right. That's, you know, great. This is the Hollywoodization of politics. Like, mm-hmm. you know, like, what is it? They say politics is like the ugly man's Hollywood. Right. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. Although they say that when you're a great communicator like Reagan was,
sure.
you can certainly get a lot done. It's like what you said, you know, your personality can go a long way.
Well,
sure.
And also,
but...
I mean, listen, you know, if you're a great communicator, you can sell, you know, a ketchup lollipop to a girl wearing white gloves. Like,
yeah.
it doesn't matter. You know, you can sell anything. But I think. Yeah. The other thing that I think is really important is that being a great communicator is also super important for a president because, you know, you sure. have to get the people, you have to frame the issue for them. There's a process of consciousness raising where people, you know, have to make the people aware, like, oh, wait, we have to change course. Like, you have to realize, yeah, we're going to go into World War II.
Sure.
Yeah, we're going to have to win. Yeah,
sure.
people are going to have to tighten their belts and all of that sort of stuff, mm-hmm. you know.
But I also want to say that, like, the content of communication is important. So, for mm-hmm. instance, Ronald Reagan was a phenomenal communicator. I don't think anybody disavows that on regardless of their political preferences. But, you know, when he was running against George W. Bush in the primary, right, H.W., rather, you know, so 41 versus 43, you know, H.W. was clearly, I mean, more intelligent. I think it seemed as though H.W. was clearly more civically minded. Like, this was a man, you know, like, sure, he was the director of the CIA. CIA may be problematic and so on and so forth. But he was also someone who sat on the board of the United Negro College Fund. He was also someone who was very, you know, civically active. He was the old school statesman self, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something to be said for that. You know, Ronald Reagan could smooth talk, you know, but... You know, if you had to ask me, and, you know, and that's why I'm here, I would have much rather that George H.W. Bush had won in 1980, right, than Ronald Reagan in terms of the trajectory that American kind of American culture went in.
Right.
Okay. Not. I mean, not to make it specifically about that choice.
Sure.
But I think a lot of what this country reacts against, and mm-hmm. I agree with them,
sure.
is the fact that, you know, when we talk about a president who's more intelligent, what we tend to mean is that they went to certain fancy schools, they belong in these certain sure. fancy institutions and all of that sort of stuff. And I think that's the thing, is that I think that, you know, even that, to a certain extent, becomes about the flash rather than the substance, right? In the same way that there's the flash of Reagan, there's also the flash of, you know, Bush, which is that he has this pedigree. He's on the United College, Negro College Fund. And I think that's the thing. I want to go back to what you originally said, which is it has to be about ideas. Like, what is your model of foreign policy? Sure. What is your basis for thinking that? Sure. Does that fit with reality? What
and
is your model?
And please, you at least know what the Bush Doctrine is.
Yeah, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Call me crazy.
That's true.
You know, I mean, and if you don't, you know, you can't be president of the United States and John McCain will lose, right? Like, I mean, I
also look at their past resume. I mean, I also look at what they've actually done and accomplished. One of the things that worried me about Obama was that he didn't leave much of an academic or legislative legacy. I mean, he voted absent most of the time or whatever that is. And that was worrying to me. But then I think he's also a very practical, prudent guy and a cautious guy. Maybe that is.
But
maybe
don't
that's
all of those things
thing.
Distract you from the ideas? Like, we've gone to talking about like what the guy did or didn't do, what choices he made, and all that sort of stuff. But I think that all of that distracts from the ideas. Like, you can have the best voting record in the world. You can, you know, be a great communicator like Reagan, and you can have the pedigree of Bush and all of those sorts of stuff. But if you believe that foreign policy works in a way that does not fit with reality, then you're going to be a terrible president.
That's true, man.
And I think that's the thing. It's really got to be about ideas. Like, that's what we have to get back to.
Well, sure. But I mean, I think something that's interesting even about Obama's election in 2008 was that, you know, it was very much about ideas, right? Like, there were all sorts of ideas. No, I mean, even in terms of getting money out of government, in terms of, I mean, like, in terms of, you know, changes and what have you. And I say this because I was a policy advisor on the campaign and, you know, like, wrote part of the website. You know, I believed in the ideas.
Yeah.
I believed in the ideas.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that, you know, so there's also the difference between the candidate and the actual elected official, right? Now, on the one hand, right, you can see that, I mean, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that, for instance, Obama, when it came to poverty, when it comes to poverty policies, when you look at his budget proposals for the first 6 years of him being in the White House, right, you know, out of eight, right, what you see is that he actually, like, in terms of the ideas, you know, in terms of poverty policy, it actually has transferred. Right. Like that on the one hand, you know, he did argue about strengthening the middle class. But even in terms of poverty policy, what that's meant is that he's been working or advocating for the poor to try to lift the floor. Mm-hmm. Right. Basically, in terms of, you know, lifting people up and increasing the size and the scope of the middle class, the safe, you know, the kind of safety net, as it were. On the other hand, though, when you see, you know, kind of all of his foreign policy, you know, and the ideas that were put forth on foreign policy in the campaign, that has not transferred into the actual, like, administration itself, right? You do see more money going into education, but that's been problematic if we want to talk about Arne Duncan, right? Like, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of ways we can go with that. But at least we know, you know, like that, like, you want people to run on ideas, but you also want them to stick to those ideas, right?
Yeah.
And I think that there's a huge accountability issue.
But you
going
know,
forward.
As, you know, as a student of politics, that you can propose an idea, and then it's going to get watered down. I mean, because of so many different special interests, or just the way government works, which maybe is not such a bad thing. Laws are made that way. Everybody debates, and it comes out.
But the question is, why is that watering down happening? Is that watering
it's
down?
Been the case.
But no, of course. But the point is that it's not that watering down is a bad thing. It's the process of watering down. If you're watering down because, you know what, we're working out something between, you know, the majority party and the minority party, and we're coming to consensus, that's one thing. But if it's being watered down through special interests,
which it is,
then it's a
that's
totally
the number
different
one reason.
But that's a totally different form of watering down.
Did you follow the Obamacare? How different was the proposal from the actual, has it been, and will it be, and I don't want you don't have a crystal ball, but I've heard doctors and I've heard a lot of people who just really rail against it. And I spent a lot of time trying to read about it and understand it.
Yeah.
It was a bill that was something like 2,400 pages long. Nobody read it, and who could?
Well, I mean, also they were asked to pass it without, like, in short periods of time without actually, I mean, you need time to read 2,400 pages, right? But, I mean, and as we talked about this before, even with, like, the way things go to conference committee in terms of agreements, right, between the House and the Senate, you get bills change in massive ways overnight, Right. And as such, and then it goes back to both houses of Congress, and they have like a day or two to like go over 2,400 pages. That's a problem. I mean, that's a problem for anyone. Like, Jesus. You know, what I would say is that.
Is it on Audible?
Yes, with Jeremy Irons.
Jeremy Irons reads the
James
horrible
Earl Jones reads.
There you go.
Yeah,
there you go. That would that would make me rather
actually
rather happy.
Samuel L. Jackson. I mean, I don't know if you've had heard his reading of "Go
you
the
guys,
Fuck to Sleep."
Have you guys ever seen this motherfucking bill is too long for me to read.
Section but, one.
Yeah, but so first off, I think that you know, like. Pharmaceutical companies were the first to kind of get in on stuff, right? And so they, you know, and they were also when, you know, you saw Medicare debates in 2004, 2005, right? This was what was going on. You know, that big special interests, very moneyed interests, right, get in early, and then they get to kind of shape and frame the debate that follows. Right. And so that was a problem. I mean, at one point, you know, and this was when Obama goes and talks to a joint session of Congress. This was, you know, when Joe Wilson yells out, "You lie."
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, like Obama had pointed out that, look, you know, this should not necessarily rule out single payer. Right. Which arguably I would favor.
Explain to us what single payer is.
Okay, so single payer is basically what Medicare is. Okay, where healthcare is largely run by the government, mm-hmm. right? Now, not entirely. You can also opt for private care outside, in addition to your healthcare. But you pay into healthcare, just like people now. I make an income, and someday I will get my back pay from UCLA. But in the meantime, I make an income, and of that income, I'm paying into Medicare, right? And the idea is that I'm paying into Medicare with the, you know, and that, you know, once I turn 65 or whatever the eligible age is at the time I retire, right, that I will basically...
97.
yeah, they're increasing the age due to costs.
Yeah.
Trust
me,
kids. It may not be 65 by the time you're ready to retire if you're not 65 already. But so single payer is basically this idea that you're paying in, right? And as such, you know, you have government-run healthcare, that you can go to any healthcare center, you know, and derive the benefits of paying into the system. Mm-hmm. One of the greatest benefits of this is the fact that you have a collective, right? Which is that you have so many people who are in the system, right, who don't need healthcare, that the people who do, you know, can derive the benefits when they need it. And that also that you'll have the benefits once you're there. This is how insurance companies, large employers.
Social Security and everything.
Yeah, but large employers are able to negotiate, you know, lower rates with insurance companies based upon the number of people that they actually have employed for them, mm-hmm. right? So this is the negotiation tactic. Well, you know, when you look at other governments, what you find is that, you know, because you have, if you're covering the entire population, right, you have a huge collective, in which case it offers you tremendous bargaining power. The United States government has actually been very horrible when it comes to negotiating, right, and to negotiating lower costs for prescriptions, which, you know, compared to other, you know, like any number of European countries. Yeah,
they've been horrible at it implies that they've tried.
Like,
The Bush Prescription Drug Act is a $1 trillion handout to the pharmaceutical companies.
Exactly.
We can't buy pharmaceuticals from Canada. We can't get a bulk discount. Like, it's, you know, such a large customer, you would think you'd be able to get a bulk discount. You can't get a bulk discount because they fixed in those prices. And why did they fix in those prices?
Special interest.
Campaign
exactly.
finance.
But even so, that's why earlier today, like...
I got to be able to high-five something. Anyway, keep going.
High-five yourself, Brian.
Yeah, you got it. I'm with you, man. But so here, okay, so yes, they have not negotiated. In fact, they have done whatever pharmaceutical companies want to mm-hmm. instead of negotiating better prices for our seniors. But were you to change to single payer, right, and with the hopes that, you know, our government wasn't bought out, knock on wood, what you would see is that you would have a large number of persons covered, i.e. 330 million people, give or take. You know, and with that ability, with such large numbers, you'd be able to ostensibly get the bulk rate, right? Mm-hmm. It's like Costco, but on a massive scale.
But in order for that to happen, and I just want to, firstly, I want to clarify, it's not just the Republicans, it's the Democrats.
No. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's both sides of the aisle.
Oh, they're in bed, baby.
They're in bed. And the point is that, you know, before you can get that bulk rate, right? What has to be fixed is
campaign finance.
Campaign finance. And before campaign finance can be fixed, the people have to wake up to the fact that that's the thing that needs to be fixed first.
Okay. Okay, Vanessa. Yeah,
okay.
So now that we've moved it to that, and I love this, can you take us through? Because, see, part of this podcast that we were talking about is that there are a lot of people who are embarrassed to admit that they don't even know what campaign finance reform means. They don't even know what that problem is, what it means to fix it, or anything else. We just hear about it a lot.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So can you give us a crash course on, and I'm putting you on the spot.
Of course.
But can you, but it's fun.
But this is my job, right?
She'll be back. Yeah. Can you give us a crash course on what campaign finance reform, why we would even entertain the idea?
Sure.
What it means? Maybe we need to actually talk about how money works in politics.
Okay.
When you're a congressman.
Okay, so let's say, for instance, you know, for sake of argument, that my first job out of college was a fundraiser for Senator Boxer, right? Because it was. you know, and my job, like, amongst other things, besides trying to, like, basically, you know, suck up to a bunch of rich people, was also...
rich people, just again to clarify, doesn't just mean rich individuals or rich corporations. It also means rich unions.
Yes, it does. Yes,
especially
it does.
Especially for Barbara Boxer.
But they had limits, mm-hmm. right? You know, there were... limits that were, you know, relatively safely in place. But we were largely going for individual contributions or PAC contributions, but PAC contributions were set at like $5,000, you know, so at the time.
What is a PAC, please?
Okay, PAC is a political affairs committee.
Yep.
Basically, it is a federally recognized entity, right? So you have to actually register with the FEC, which is the Federal Election Commission, right? And a PAC, so I could start a PAC. It could be the VCT PAC, Vanessa C. Tyson PAC, right? And I would, you know, I would have to register it with the FEC, right? And then I could start raising money to be that would be allowed to be federally permissible by U.S. for U.S. campaigns. So once I have my PAC, then I can.
When you get registered, do you have to have a criteria, a manifesto that you submit, or is it just?
Not, I mean, it could be like a 2-page thing.
Okay.
Right. I mean,
we could do it, Brian.
Yeah, it's not that hard. I mean, that's how Stephen Colbert did his Colbert PAC.
Okay.
Right. It's.
Pretty quick.
Trust
easy.
Me.
All right.
Okay. So, you know, it's like a 2-page form you fill out, and then you can start raising money. Now, all of this money has to be regulated, right? So it's monitored by the FEC. So if I have money, if I'm raising money from donors, there's a limit in terms of how much money I can take from individual donors. There was before Citizens United.
Okay. So how much can I give as a citizen? What's the most I can give?
For a PAC, the most you can give is about $5,000. Now, if it's a super PAC, right, which is what was created after Citizens United, you could give me as much money as you want to. That's how Sheldon Adelson can give $20 million to Mitt Romney's super PAC. Oh, yeah.
So how do you
form
a super
That's
PAC?
That's hack. Another 2-page paper.
But don't you have to have a lot of people involved?
No.
Well, how do I call it a PAC versus a super PAC?
Okay, so what happens in the Citizens United case, right? So this is 2010, January 2010, right? Now, mind you, I'm about
a date that shall live in infamy.
Oh my God, yeah, because I had to go into my class, my Intro to American Politics class, and I was am I allowed to swear here?
Yeah.
I was going batshit crazy. I was just like, I mean, I was about ready to like spontaneously combust because this opinion had just been handed down that day, right? And I was like, do you know what this means for the future of America? Like, I was just, I was distraught. I was beyond distraught. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, oh God, I was taken aback. But so Citizens United passes and basically says, you know, along the lines of corporations are people, right? You know, like, which Mitt Romney was quite a fan of, if we recall. And basically what it means is that, you know, that this is what part of the argument becomes that, you know, that money is speech, first off, right? And that's a big deal.
Buy more
because
airtime?
If we, you know, so that, well, yeah, money is speech, mm-hmm. right? And so what this means is that, and you had cases prior, Buckley versus Valeo back in the 70s, which upheld the idea that, yes, you could have campaign funding, right? You could have mm-hmm. campaign donations, because it was protected as free speech. But what the Supreme Court also argued in Buckley versus Valeo was this idea that while it was free speech, it should be corralled, right, with limits, mm-hmm. right, to prevent the improper influence of special interests,
yeah.
right? That was the Buckley sure. versus Valeo 1973, right? Now fast forward, Citizens United 2010, right? Basically, if this money is speech, right, then every entity should be allowed to speak, and not just individuals.
Under
right?
the First Amendment.
Yes. And so, exactly. So it's under the First Amendment, this is protected speech, which is a campaign contribution, right? And what the lawyers
So money is speech. So by giving money, basically, I am lubricating my candidate's vocal cords.
Exactly.
I'm giving him more time to speak on radio and television.
Which is exactly what Sheldon Adelson did. That's exactly what the Koch brothers have done. This is exactly what any number of large Democratic donors have done as well.
So Citizens United comes through. It gets passed by the...
No,
it's
a Supreme Court case.
Okay.
Right? So it's a 5-4 decision, but it goes down. And this is where, you know, Obama says in his State of the Union, you know, you've opened the floodgates to money in politics. And Sam Alito, or, you know, Justice Alito is in the audience going, no. Right. But, you know, and this was like about a week after they had handed down this decision. Right. And what we've seen, though, is that it has indeed opened the floodgates. So now you can start a super PAC. You can get your rich friends, you know, like be it Sheldon Adelson or the Koch brothers or whomever. Like, I mean, I got to find me some billionaire friends. But suffice it to say, you can now have a super PAC. And this super PAC, you know, people can give unlimited amounts of money.
Mm-hmm.
To the super PAC. Jesus. Now, here's the deal. The rule, the technical rule, is that the super PAC is not allowed to coordinate with the candidate, him or herself.
Right.
Which, right. Yeah, now this
so
becomes...
So I can kind of say, I can't really necessarily say I'm a super PAC. I can't say, vote for Mitt Romney. I can say, though, that I can pay for my own commercial supporting one of his...
So I start the VCT PAC, VCT Super PAC. I have now just, you know, I have corralled all of my multi-zillionaire friends, mm-hmm. right, to give me tons of money. And you decide you're running for office, right? Mm-hmm. Now, we're not allowed to, you know, to...
Endorse me.
Oh, no. I can endorse
you. Endorse me.
Yeah, sure. Okay. You know, but we're not allowed to coordinate,
yes.
right, our efforts. So you have your campaign, and I have the Super PAC, and we're not allowed to coordinate. That said, you and I can hang out all the time.
Really?
Oh, hell yeah. Well, we can hang out all the time. We could be besties.
Yeah.
Right? We could just, like, chill all the time. I mean, now, and we're just not supposed to coordinate the activities between the campaign, mm-hmm. your campaign, right? And let's say Hunter's your campaign manager, right? You know, we're not allowed, you guys can't coordinate with me. I've got the $1 billion, right? But we can hang out all the time.
Jesus Christ. So, in other words, so now with super PACs, of course, as an individual, it makes sense for me to join a PAC or super PAC.
Oh yeah,
especially a super PAC.
It's a good idea to start your own PAC.
So a PAC can only a PAC
because then you control it. Like if I have my VCT PAC, I control the cash that the billions of dollars that people are giving me.
Okay, but so that's great. So a political action committee can only give $5,000. A super political action committee
super PAC.
Can give $20 million.
Limitless.
Yeah. Limitless.
And there was really no distinction between a PAC and a super PAC.
Well, the...
Super PAC just has more money.
Practically speaking, no, right?
I mean, they're registered differently with the FEC. Mm-hmm. Takes about the same amount of paperwork. 2 pages. That's about it.
Jesus.
Yeah. And something that I want to throw in as well, and this is from Lawrence Lessig's Republic Lost,
okay.
right, is, and this goes back to what you were saying earlier, right? What money in politics does is it turns up the volume on speech. And if you imagine what happens when you turn up, if you have a bunch of people with microphones and you just turn up the volume on everybody's microphones, well, what happens? Everybody just starts shouting and shouting and louder, and there's no productive conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what ends up happening in the United States. That's what's happened since the 1960s. And usually the Nixon-Kennedy debate is talked about as the turning point,
yep.
as everybody just shouts and shouts and shouts, and there's no possibility of meaningful conversation.
Well, the good thing about that might be that people just tune out and take care of their own lives.
Yeah. Well, they tune out, but they also don't vote, and they also become more and more disillusioned.
Well, because
and
we don't
yet,
live, we
and
don't
special
have,
interests become more and more powerful.
We don't have yeah. representative government.
And then,
anymore,
and that's the point.
It's not a representative democracy.
It's not a democracy anymore.
Yeah, it's an economy of influence.
It's a plutocracy. It's an yeah. oligarchy. It's a, basically yeah. what happens is that, you know, the banks and the teachers' unions and you know, all these different special interests come in and they write the laws the way they want them, and we
and
all
and then
lose.
They have no. But not only do the lobbyists write the laws, then they pick the member of Congress that they want to carry it.
That's right.
Right. Like, so most members of when you're looking at laws that are being put into place, most of them were written by the special interests themselves.
I know.
Right. And so that's what you're dealing with. But then you have to think
about each other out. I mean, special interests were supposed to balance
sure.
each other out.
I mean, yeah, that's the idea of pluralism.
Each other out,
but
you know?
The key to them balancing each other
faction
out.
Faction versus faction.
But the key, right. I mean, ambition must be set against ambition, right? But the key to them balancing each other out is Federalist Paper number 52. The government must be dependent upon the people alone. And that's the problem, is that, you know, if a candidate is not going to the people and figuring out what's going to get the people to vote for him, right, and instead his attention is, it doesn't have to be fully on the special interests, even if his attention is
it's
just divided and it's on fundraisers, then what happens is that, you know, he's serving two masters.
Sure.
And instead of just serving the people, he's also serving these people in the back end, right, and trying to figure out, what am I going to say, what am I going to do?
And he also feels entitled. He also, as a human being, even if he's a good person,
absolutely
feels emboldened or at least in debt to mm-hmm. the group that got him in power in the first place.
That's right.
Which so, aren't poor people.
They're not poor people. They're
no.
powerful. So this is this sounds like the central issue in politics.
It is. I mean, I would argue that
it
is.
You would argue, and you're,
oh, yeah.
you're a professor
and I mean,
of political science.
But I mean, when you think about it, and Hunter and I were talking about this before, right? Like, you know, that both parties are complicit, right? In fact, they are actively acting, you know, within this structure.
Well, because you've
right?
set up an incentive.
With the exception of Bernie Sanders, we got to give credit where credit's
but you set up an incentive structure which makes it impossible not to be that way.
That's right.
Exactly.
So you'd have to be a fool not to game the system or have your fundraisers and have your lobbyists. That's why do you think probably they are expanding construction all the way out to Dulles Airport? I don't think that those counties in Rockland County and Bethesda, et cetera, all the counties surrounding Washington, D.C., I don't think they have thriving manufacturing industries. What I do think they have is industries of influence.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
So, certainly.
So then the question becomes, this is for another time, Vanessa, what do we do about it?
Well, I mean, but that's the thing. Just to button that, it yeah. goes back to the point is that step one
ideas.
Is the people. It's the people yeah. understanding that campaign finance is issue one. And part of it also goes back to, we had Jim Rickards on, right, mm-hmm. who wrote a book called
yeah.
The Death of Money.
Yeah.
And he just talked about the fact that, you know, they use the most boring, confusing terminology for all of this stuff, right? Like, they talk about quantitative easing, right, and all these great euphemisms that disguise what they're actually doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we called campaign finance, and I don't know what it is, but if we called it, you know, democracy for sale or whatever it is, like, people would get a lot more upset. And if they
oh, sure.
understood that this is not, I mean, that's the point. And I think, you know, again, I recommend Republic Lost. It's not a partisan issue.
And the other thing, though, is that I think we can create rules within the structures to actually encourage participation,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, and this is a problem that, you know, Hunter and I were talking about this before you got here. You were stuck in traffic. We were talking about the fact that, you know, if you change the rules, you encourage people to play who might not otherwise play.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
And that's the name of the game. You want a democracy, that means that you have to have everyone participate.
Mm-hmm.
And I would honestly say that many, many politicians, both, you know, from all different walks, right, don't actually want that kind of participation.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll leave it at that, Vanessa Tyson. Thank you. This is a round two, part two of perhaps four or more.
How many rounds can a Tyson go?
We'll see.
I can go forever.
Yeah. She was an athlete.
Brute mental force.
Dang mm-hmm. right. Well, your ideas and your clarity and your voice is important, and I think that you know, I actually learned a lot today because you made it very clear, the two of you. Oh. So I appreciate that.
Thank you. And
Brian, don't be too modest.
I'm just so busy.
It's
just
the Three Musketeers. The Three Musketeers.
And I'm getting in a ring today and I'm going to be sparring with a bunch of 22-year-olds. So I hope I don't get hurt.
You're going to be awesome.
Yeah. Well, I'm very supple. And so, by the way, everybody, two things I want to say. First of all, I'm sorry about the squeaky chairs. Just deal with it. I think it adds character to the podcast. Otherwise, it sounds too professional. And secondly, I got some flack about DraftKings, my sponsor. I like that company, and I think it's a good company, and I believe in fantasy football. I don't play it myself, but it's gambling. Maybe you want to call it gambling. I don't care what you call it. As far as I'm concerned, you've got to be really skilled to win money, and you got to know your sport. So I'm proud to sponsor DraftKings, and I will continue to. So keep your emails to yourself. How's that sound? All right.
Or alternatively, send us so much money that we don't need sponsorship.
Yeah. And not only that, I think I'm going to start playing DraftKings just for spite. And I'm going to gamble. I'm going to gamble an irresponsible amount of money. Because I think gambling should be legal, as do I think prostitution and everything else. But that's just me. That's for
Brian,
another
would
time.
You be a buyer or a seller of prostitution?
Well, look, man, I don't want to lose my house in Calabasas. I just got it. So that's the problem. Unless I could bring her into the mix and then, you know. That's a whole issue.
I was talking about you, Brian.
Oh, sorry, guys. Guys. Sorry, this is we were talking about campaign finance reform and then I jumped into hookers. That's my old life.
Jesus. Oh, my God.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been, well, you know what it's been. I don't even know what the name of this podcast is anymore.
Yeah.
I'm tired of the Brian Callen Show.
The show.
It's been the show.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.